logic of the argument is very much like the logic of the arguments that you might have or might not have seen in any detail in the cosmology class, where you're asking about relics, because the theme of cosmology is the evidence for cosmology now is typically you see relics from the hot history of the universe, and those relics are the things that are the markers that something happened in the past, and the universe was once hot in the past. So the spirit of this kind of an argument is very much the spirit of those arguments, and you're just asking of how, under what circumstances do you have leftover particles from the much earlier universe? And they're left over in the sense that in the much earlier universe, things were hotter, everything was much more abundant, and we want to know what controls the abundance now. And that's all about, often, in these thermal cases, about the departure from equilibrium, because if things are in equilibrium, what's nice about that as an initial state is that it's very generic. You don't need to know much about what happened before. If I tell you that at some point in time the universe was just in thermal equilibrium, and from then on everything else is understandable in terms of that equilibrium, what's nice is that everything before the equilibrium point becomes irrelevant, largely, because how you get to equilibrium doesn't matter once you get there. It's like Russian novels, you know, the ones that are happy, they're all happy the same way. So equilibrium is happy in the same way. It doesn't matter how you get there. It's obviously true that your equally properties are dictated by equilibrium itself.
Would you turn your microphone on, please?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. All my best jokes are missing because my microphone's on.
So the upshot is that equilibrium, what's nice about equilibrium from the point of view of an initial condition, in that it makes you not have to care about what happened earlier than that, makes it not so nice when you're trying to look for evidence for an early hot time. Because if people stay in equilibrium, then equilibrium, if we had equilibrium now, we would be equally insensitive to what was going on at earlier times than now, as we are when we think of earlier times from the initial conditions where we posit equilibrium. So the fact that you get relics and you can calculate things, it's all about getting out of equilibrium, because it's the departures from equilibrium that are the ones that are specific to how the universe evolved. So that means that we need to talk about review kind of the conditions for equilibrium. So the relics and departures from equilibrium are the most informative about earlier history. So what we want to know is what's the criterion for equilibrium and why the expanding universe is always causing a problem with equilibrium. So to warm that up, remember that let's start with equilibrium is, you know, if we hadn't been doing cosmology, we would have said that thermal equilibrium is all about we have a bunch of particles, they're interacting with each other, and then if the rates of interaction are sufficiently fast, then you arrive at a state where, if you can arrive at a place where the rates are so fast that rates for reactions to go in all different directions are balanced, you know, that is equilibrium, essentially, and that's that state will be special in the sense that things will be static, but it'll also be true that the abundances of everything is controlled by this condition of detailed balance rather than by specifics of the interactions. And then the criterion is whether or not you're in equilibrium or not is really whether the reactions that are happening are fast enough to allow detailed balance to happen. So what I want to do is there's two curves that are being thrown at you in cosmology, one of which is, because you're in effectively an expanding box, the temperature is falling all the time. And so how fast reactions have to happen is related to the temperature that you think is of your equilibrium. And if that temperature is always falling, then the things that were once in equilibrium need not stay in equilibrium, because the temperature is always a falling thing. And the rate with which it falls is governed by the expansion of the universe. The second curve is everything is relativistic. Or many things are relativistic in cosmology. And when most of us learn statistical mechanics and thermodynamics, we tend to learn it for non-relativistic systems, because that's what is of most interest in practice. And there's some specifics about non-relativistic versus non-relativistic statistical mechanics and that you should know about. And in particular, the main one is when you do statistical mechanics, you're normally thinking that when you are in equilibrium, you get to talk about things like chemical potentials, and you have a chemical potential for each particle species, if you like, and that's the thing that allows you to adjust the average number of particles in your bath to be whatever you like. That's kind of what chemical potentials normally do when you learn about it as undergraduates. But that's, for relativistic systems, that's a deceptive way to think about chemical potentials. The way to think about chemical potentials is really, if you go right back to the roots of them, the things that you're allowed to specify in a bath are the things that were not changing collision by collision, because the things that change collision by collision are very fast, and you're trying to follow things that are very long, on very long timescales compared to the fast collisions, and that's kind of why you're doing thermodynamics and statistical mechanics rather than doing the details of what's going on. And in non-relativistic systems, the number of particles is typically conserved, but in relativistic systems, it's usually not conserved because the particles and the antiparticles are always taking each other out. So if you kind of have a relativistic system where you have interactions going on, typically the number of particles is changing on the timescale of your collision. So it's not a variable that you should be expecting to be able to fix from the outside, because as soon as you try and fix it, it'll want to change. It's because your particles that you're trying to fix the abundance of will find antiparticles, and you'll immediately start to change the number of particles that are there. So it shouldn't be possible to constrain their value from the outside with a chemical potential. The things that you can constrain are the things that are not changing in collisions, and those will be the conserved things. So a special role is always being played by conserved things, because those are the ones where, because of their conservation, you're not changing them collision by collision. So you can imagine setting an initial condition where you have a certain amount of some conserved thing, and that will never go away because it's conserved. The way the chemical potentials come into that are, in non-relativistic systems, particle number is usually conserved, and that's kind of why you talk about particle number chemical potentials. But what you should really be thinking about is that you have a chemical potential for every conserved thing, and that may or may not be the number of particles you're interested in talking about. So I want to step right back to that and make the argument for how the equilibrium distributions depend on chemical potentials, because that's something which drives all the other things you do later on. So the main curve, so there's two, you know, warnings about StatMech in cosmology. So one is relativistic particles and that has implications for what you do with chemical potentials, and the other one is the expanding universes changes some things. All right, so how does that work? So let me first go back to the very beginning, the detailed balance story. So how do you, because if I'm telling you that some things are changing from your statistical mechanics because the things are relativistic, the first thing you say is, whoa, you know, how do I trust anything? So what can I trust? So let me just remind you of the detailed balance argument, because this is also will play a role in our equilibrium story. Actually, before we do that, let's do the thermodynamics. So because the logic in which I've been doing it so far is we've been talking about the stuff in cosmology that depends on conservation laws. Next step we can talk about is, if we want to talk about thermal properties, let's talk about the thermal properties that are dictated just by thermodynamics. And then the second thing will be, what can you say about those things if you add the additional information with statistical mechanics? So thermodynamics, let's just do a little thermodynamics in an expanding universe. So we've talked about how energy density varies with time. It goes like 1 over A to 3 if the pressure is if the pressure divided by the density is 0. And the energy density goes like 1 over A to the 4th if the pressure of the energy density is about a third. So this is for matter and radiation. And what we want to know now is if we have a thermal, if the thing we're looking at is in thermal equilibrium, it'll have a temperature, what's the temperature doing? So at one level, this is really stupidly easy. So if we have radiation, so for radiation, at temperature T, we know that the thing about radiation is that there's no scale in that problem because it's all massless. But now if you have a temperature, you have a scale. So what happens relativistically normally in statistical mechanics is that for relativistic, ultra-relativistic massless things, everything that you calculate is the temperature to the appropriate power on dimensional ground. So T sets the scale. So what we expect is to find that the number density of particles, that's the number of particles per unit volume. So that's going to go like, that has dimensions of 1 over length cubed. So in fundamental units, we're using always h bar as c as Boltzmann's constant is equal to 1. So this thing is 1 over length cubed. So that's an energy cubed. That's a temperature cubed. That has to be some number times t cubed. The energy density is an energy per unit volume, so that's an energy divided by length cubed, so that's energy to the fourth, so that'll be some other number times t to the fourth, and so on. The pressure, similarly, was, you know, it's one-third the energy density, so that's also going like t to the fourth. So if we want to ask how is the temperature changing as the universe expands, then if we compare this or this to this, then you can kind of see that if the universe is going, if rho is varying with a, like 1 over a to the fourth, and rho is varying with t, like t to the fourth, then t has to be going like 1 over a. So rho goes like 1 over a to the fourth, and rho goes like t to the fourth, so t goes like 1 over a. And that's something which I'm sure you've seen before. We could do the same thing for non-relativistic matter, and of course here you need to be a little bit more the zero here, we have to go back and rethink what the pressure was. And for non-relativistic matter, if it's an ideal gas, the pressure isn't really zero. It's given by the temperature. And this ratio here was really not so much zero. It's more like the temperature divided by the mass. So if we want to know how the temperature is changing in that case, we can make the same kind of an argument. We can ask how rho varies as a function of A, then ask how rho varies as a function of T, and then make the comparison. And then the statement is, you know, this statement here is if this and if this, and so this part of it is the statement of equilibrium, then this. So it's a, seems like a very simple line of thought. So in the non-relativistic case, remember we had the pressure was the ideal gas law, and the energy density was the number density times the mass of the particle plus the temperature divided by gamma minus 1, where gamma was the ratio of specific heats, and it was equal to 5/3 for monatomic gas. So it's no longer quite so obvious because it's not just a simple power of t. But what we have to do is what we really are doing is we're saying, you know, if we know that this is what rho is as a function of time, the way we derive the dependence on a was rho goes like 1 over a cubed came from energy conservation, right? Remember that rho dot plus basically energy conservation was a ddt of rho a cubed plus the pressure times ddt of a cubed was equal to zero. That was like the thermodynamic statement of energy. The change in the energy is equal to the work done as the volume of the universe expands. Well, if you think of this as a formula for rho dot, but you think of now rho as a function of temperature, you can trade rho dot for t dot, and you can turn this into an equation for how the T dot is related to A dot. So this equation, all I'm doing is I'm formalizing the argument that was made over there for more complicated functions of temperature. So star and star star together imply that the temperature satisfies that T dot over T plus 3 gamma minus 1 A dot over A is zero, which you can integrate to get that t in this case goes like a to the, I'll never remember the power, so let me, so it's 1 over a to the 3 gamma minus 1. And so in the case of gamma equals 5/3, which is the the straight up vanilla monotonic gas. And this is 5/3 minus 3/3 is 2/3 times 3. So this would have been T equals like 1 over A squared. And that's kind of, that's what it is. So why am I telling you this story? I'm telling you this story because I want to get to the equilibrium story. And you know that this logic that I'm using is assuming that the energy is conserved for the each component that we're talking about. So writing this down meant that the stress energy for the matter alone was conserved. And writing the formula rho goes like 1 over a to the fourth was the statement that the energy and the radiation was conserved on its own. Didn't mean that other things weren't there. It just meant that they weren't exchanging information. But you can kind of see that there should be a, so what do we do now if supposing the radiation we're interested in is radiation and the matter we're interested in is not dark matter, but it's baryons, protons and electrons and things. And we're interested in temperatures below the proton mass or something like that, which is a kind of a practical interest in cosmology. Then the problem will be that the matter is actually in equilibrium with the radiation. So they are exchanging information. So then the question is, what's the right rule in that case? Because in that case, the matter wanted the temperature to go like 1 over A squared, let's say, and the radiation wanted to go like 1 over A, but they're talking to each other, and the universe can only do one thing, so how does it choose what it does? And so there the same argument works, but we just have to be careful that doing it this way shows you that the right logic is that if things are in equilibrium, if you can express something whose evolution you can track, say the energy density, it might be the entropy, it depends on the physics that you think is important. Is the energy conserved in the evolution? Is it an isothermal process or is it an adiabatic process or what? So this logic of if you can express the energy in terms of the temperature for the equilibrium system and then demand that it be conserved, the total energy be conserved, that should be the thing that'll tell you how the temperature wants to vary. And so, so as a quick application, we can just make this same argument for coupled fluids, we're asking which rule wins. Does T go like 1 over A or T go like 1 over A squared? So let's say we have one fluid that's relativistic or one that's not relativistic. And the answer is, let's say we have our energy density is this. So then we would have had something which was, I'm going to call this coefficient here A sub B times temperature to the fourth. This is just what I called number over here. Let's just call this. This is a Stefan Boltzmann constant up to factors. And then we also have the matter. But then the same logic now says that this whole thing is conserved in this sense. And so we can repeat the exercise we did here. So if we use conservation, so this is, call this rho tote. Rho tote to infer T dot. And the same argument gives us the statement that T dot over T plus 1 plus sigma over sigma plus 1/3, 1 over 3 gamma minus 1, A dot over A is 0. Where sigma is just 4 A sub B T cubed divided by 3 times the number density. In this case, I would take it to be the sum. It's the ideal gas plus the
pressure of rho plus pressure.
Yeah.
Isn't the equation linear? Change the setup.
What's that?
No, I'm just wondering because it looks like they're decoupled in the end.
Yeah, where do we use the fact that they're interacting with each other?
Yeah, it looks like they're, you have two independent solutions, they're just adding them up.
You're saying that it would be true that if we knew that this was true for the matter and this was separately true for the radiation, it would also be true for the sum. because then you're saying it's linear in row. That's
oh,
true.
Right, right.
But what we don't know is that it's separately true for each of them. And where we make that, where we commit ourselves to that is we're saying that we have the pressure and the energy density are dictated by this formula for T, where T is one variable. And so by saying that, we can only say that if there's energy being exchanged between them, because that's the equilibrium assumption, that
right.
The temperature is characterizing everything. So, and part of what I guess I'm not saying explicitly, but I should be saying explicitly, is that in this case, we're imagining that the number density was some function that is not a function of temperature, right? That's the way I'm thinking of it here, is I'm thinking of it as being something which is specified, like the protons are specified. And you'll see in a second that if we had had protons and antiprotons, and we had not put in a chemical potential which said that their abundance was fixed, then what we would have found here is that the number density would have been temperature dependent, and it would have been exponentially suppressed as the temperature falls below the mass, because the protons and the antiprotons would start to find each other and annihilate. So implicitly, when what I'm telling you is I'm also using that that Na cubed is fixed. So I've imagined so it's something which is being tracked by a conserved thing. That's in the back of my mind, and that'll be more explicit once we come to the statistical mechanics part of the argument. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, I want to ask about that. If you count the particle number with negative signs for antiparticles,
yeah.
Then even in a non-relativistic case, in a relativistic case, you could consider the particle number conserved, right?
Yeah. And so with the special, so you're kind of asking, so how do you do this? If it's always really particle minus antiparticle, then well, why am I allowed to do that?
Well, it sounds like you're counting them with the positive sign, right?
Well, I'm not counting them at all. And the reason I get away with that is that the assumption was that these things were non-relativistic. So implicit in this whole thing was that the temperature was much less than the mass. And so that's why this was different from the relativistic case, the radiation case. And so in this limit, what I'm imagining is that if we had started out the universe off with, billions of antiprotons, but then billions plus a few extra protons, then once the protons and the antiprotons are annihilated, the only reason we're talking about some residual number of protons is that there were extras. And it should have been true that at low energies, once your temperature goes below some energy level, you should start to see that energy level be Boltzmann suppressed. So the surprise should have been, why are we talking about these guys at all? Because they're really high energy states compared to the temperature if we're in this regime. And the only reason we can talk about them at all is that they're carrying a conserved charge, and that conserved charge counted the particles minus the antiparticles. But if there was a difference in their number, then that difference could have had a finite non-zero value. And that's what we're tracking here, really.
So you are counting it with the minus sign.
So here, because I'm imagining that they were at low temperature, so that the antiparticles are all gone now.
Okay.
And so here, the reason we can do what you do normally in non-relativistic systems is that that's what people normally are doing in non-relativistic systems. The only reason you get to talk about electrons and protons that are not relativistic is that they're all carrying a conserved thing that forbids them from disappearing on you and carrying the energy away. And so it's because they carry a conserved thing, and because the energies are so low that all the antiparticles are now gone, effectively the number is conserved. So that'll be clear in a second when I'm going to do the statistical mechanics of this. You'll see kind of where this is coming from more explicitly.
I don't understand in the argument why the temperature being low matters, because if you count the antiparticles with minus sign, that would be conserved even at higher energies, right?
Yes. No, it would be true. No.
Yeah.
So it will be always true that if the particles minus the antiparticles is conserved, that's something you can specify because it is conserved.
Right.
But this formula and this counting, I'm doing this formula, and here I'm thinking of n counting the particles only when I write something like this.
Okay.
So I haven't talked about antiprotons. And that's actually not different from what you want to do, because because we're in this regime, what I really would have been specifying here is the density of the conserved thing, which would be the particles minus the antiparticles. But because I'm at low temperatures, there essentially are no antiparticles. So that means the thing that really was conserved is effectively the number of particles. But if I had not chosen, this whole story is only working because implicitly I would have had to have a chemical potential when we do the statistical mechanics of it, because I had to tell you that there was an excess of protons that they left over. And if I had not done that, what normally would have happened, and you'll see that does happen if we don't have a chemical potential, is that the particles and the antiparticles tend to annihilate each other, and then the density of particles and it minus the antiparticles, the conserved thing, tends to go to zero at low temperatures normally. So what normally happens, you could ask, why don't we see all the particles that ever existed in the universe around us now with some density? Because the antiparticles are gone and the particles are left. We don't, because if there's no conserved thing, the particles and the antiparticles annihilate, and there's no energy to produce them again, because once they're gone, once the temperature is too low, you don't have enough energy to produce them to run the reaction backwards to get them back.
Well, so earlier at the beginning of the lecture, you made the remark that you can't really define a chemical potential in a relativistic gas. But why not? If you define the particle number counting antiparticles with a minus sign, then the particle number would be conserved in a relativistic context. So why not use that as a particle number, then define the chemical potential to fix that value, which is conserved?
Well, that's what we're going to do. That's exactly what you're supposed to do. Yeah.
Okay.
And so that what I'm trying to do is that. When it depends on how you're trained as an undergraduate, but what often happens when you come into statistical mechanics, you come in as an undergraduate thinking that the particle numbers would be separately conserved, so you're tempted to think that you could have this, you could specify n for the particles and the antiparticle separately. That you can't do. That's the main message of the relativistic thing, so that really you have to do what you said. You have to take the conserved quantity, which will be particles minus antiparticles. But in practice, if you're in the non-relativistic limit, that becomes the same as what everyone does. Everyone in practice, that difference becomes the number of particles that are left over. If you have a mismatch between particles and antiparticles, and then that's what everybody has in their mind, but they're not telling you just explicitly when they do non-relativistic statistical mechanics.
So the chemical potential is always well-defined, right?
For conserved things. So the thing is that if you wanted to have a bath of electrons and positrons and give me a chemical potential differently for the electrons and the positron number, that would be something which, there's a sense in which that will be make sense, but it will be in a derived sense. The fundamental things you get to specify are the conserved quantities. In a way, I'm going to make it more explicit. So if it's not clear after I make it more explicit, ask it again, because I'm not sure if I got to what was bothering you. So the finish the thought here. I'm imagining here, this is n, remember, is the number density of the non-relativistic guys. And it's something which, in general, will be time-dependent. And often, it'll be time-dependent in this way, because they'll just be conserved. But it's time-dependence is independent of the time-dependence of the temperature. So in practice, this is something which can be time dependent, because it depends on how n evolves compared to how t evolves. And we're trying to learn how t evolves from this. But you can kind of see there are various situations. But the upshot of it, the way to think about this is this: you can think of this as being the entropy in the relativistic gas divided by the entropy in the non-relativistic gas. Or in this case, it's probably the energy ratio that came in. But the important part is that for example, in cosmology, the way we think it happened in our past, you have 10 to the 10 photons for every baryon. And the energy density in the baryons is often more than the photons, just because the mass of the baryon is huge compared to the temperature. But the number of photons is enormous, and their entropy is enormous. And so this ratio is kind of quantifying. If this ratio is large, then sigma is large, and this becomes 1. And then that just says that t dot over t plus a dot over a is 0. That means that t is going to go like 1 over a, like in the relativistic case. So if sigma is much bigger than 1, then t goes like 1 over a. But if the number is very small, so sigma goes to 0, then this ratio becomes that formula over there. And then t then goes like 1 over a squared. If gamma is 5/3, it does whatever I told you over there if gamma is not 5/3. And so this kind of describes the transition between these two limits. And it's all being controlled by the relative entropy in the radiation compared to the matter. So if it happened that, so let's suppose that the sigma starts off large originally. If sigma is large originally, then the temperature is going to go like 1 over a. We know that means that t goes like 1 over, t cubed goes like 1 over a cubed. If n is evolving according to this, so n is going like 1 over a cubed as well, that would mean that this ratio then would be time independent. And so as long as your sigma is large, it's going to stay large because sigma is not going to change. And then you should expect that what will happen is that t will continue going like 1 over a until something like equilibrium starts to fail. Whereas if this had originally been small, then n still goes like 1 over a cubed over there. So if sigma's small, n goes like 1 over a cubed, but t now in the small sigma limit goes like, this is when the sigma's small, t goes like 1 over a squared. So now this thing now starts to depend on a. It's going to go like 1 over a cubed. So that means as a gets larger, sigma gets smaller still. Depending on it'll actually depend on the power of. I've assumed that gamma was 5/3 when I said it goes like 1 over a cubed. So if you want to know, if you want to track a transition between this and this, that's the way you do it. Is that you Once you know how T is evolving, that's telling you how T is a function of A. You have other information that tells you how N evolves, typically that it's conserved. That tells you how sigma evolves, and that makes, you can integrate this again, but now you just have to be careful that you're integrating it when sigma is a function of A, or time. So the reason this plays an important role in some of the story I told you already, right? When I told you the story of structure formation, the baryons make holes, the dark matter makes potential wells. The baryons would like to fall into the potential wells, but I told you they don't until the radiation lets them go. This is kind of why. The baryons are tied to the radiation as long as they're in equilibrium, and it's only after the photons and the baryons no longer are in equilibrium that the temperature is allowed to, and the density of the baryons is allowed to do what it wants to do non-relativistically and allow it to fall into the holes. Before that, it's as if it was radiation, and so it's behaving relativistically because they're tied to each other. So what this example underlines is that there's competitions going on, that relativistic things want to do one thing, non-relativistic things want to do other things, and that competition is really all being driven by the equilibrium condition. The thing that drove everything was we said that everything was a function of temperature only, and that was only true because we had enough collisions going on that things were always thermalizing. So the domain of validity of the conclusions is always going to be really importantly depending on exactly when equilibrium is true. So that sets up the problem of when is equilibrium true? And what goes into the equilibrium conditions?
Sorry.
Yeah.
So just to understand, in the beginning, like very early after Big Bang, we would have like a large sigma, it would be the radiation dominated period of expansion, right?
Well, this is the important distinction. So when you say radiation domination, what you're saying is that the dominant amount of energy density is in the radiation. And that's independent of what's going on here?
It's a little independent. So it means like this would be valid until, say, decoupling or whatever, but this has nothing to do with, you know, for example, when you had like matter radiation equality or anything. Like
right. Okay. So and the important thing is because all I'm ever using is this. And so I'm using the energy is conserved component by component, or in the case of baryons and photons, the sum of them has been conserved. But I'm not assuming anywhere that these things are dominating the universe.
Okay.
Where I would use that is if I told you what A was doing as a function of time.
Right.
Because that's where you're using a Hubble square is equal to rho, and then you know what rho is a function of A. And so I deliberately have not used what A was as a function of time in any of this because of that. Okay. So equilibrium. So equilibrium is all about detailed balance. So the way it's convenient that normally when people would set it up is you'd ask. So what I want to first do is what are the conditions for detailed balance? So we've got a bath of things. We've got a whole bunch of states. Let's call them I. So I labels all the states available to me. And we've got and all states are populated at some level. And let's say that we have, let's say that F I is the density of the particle density. Particle density for species I, and it's a function of x and p, if you like, in phase space. So the number of particles, the total number of particles of species I would be the integral over position and momentum of this f. And I'm going to actually call this n, because if I don't, I'm going to get it wrong all the time, because in my notes, that's what I called it. But this is the thing that David Morrissey in his notes was calling f. So
the script.
Yeah, that was supposed to be a script N. Yeah. I said F probably, right? Yeah. All right, so equilibrium is supposed to be a place where the densities of particles are not changing. But really what the real statement should be that if I take any piece of phase space, the rate at which things scatter into that piece of phase space should be equal to the rate at which things scatter out. That would be what you'd mean by detailed balance. So the differential rate for scattering in minus out of a region of phase space it'll be the rate at which you scatter, you know, I goes to J summed over all I, just schematically. If I'm interested in, and let's say I'm interested in what happens for it to phase case labeled by J. So J is some piece of momentum, some piece of position for some specific particle types, and I do that for all the particle types, as I've told you all those things. So what I would want to know, if I want to know what the rate of change of that is, I would be asking for all the times that things scatter into I, into J from I, and I'd want to subtract from it all the times that things scatter out of it. And if that were zero, then I would expect the density of those particles in phase space, whatever is describing the probability of having that piece of phase space occupied, should be fixed. So detailed balance would be the statement that these things are equal. That's the statement. And you remember that these rates that I'm talking about, in practice, they're going to be cross-sections, or they're going to be rates, so it'll be cross-sections summed over the final states and weighted by the probability of initial states. So it'll always be some, let me leave the initial state thing for a second. There'll be some differential cross-section times the relative velocity for that for the particles involved times the product over all the final states. So let's say we're doing I goes to J. So all the states, say A contained in J. So let's say J is a 10 particle state. I'm summing over all the particles in that final state with some final D3P A. And this cross section is going to come to you as, or actually, I changed my notation on you just a little bit, so let me just leave it like that. What I meant to say was where d sigma is a thing that would have been some S matrix element, you know, final S matrix initial squared times the final state product over momenta D3P final. All you need to know, and sorry, there's one last thing I didn't write here. So the rate for a reaction, normally what you would have said is that it would be the cross-section. The cross-section is really defined to be the rate divided by the flux. And the flux is the initial particles that I haven't written here yet times the velocity. And that's, you only define the cross-section because you're trying to remove the, in a collision, the total rate depends on two things. It depends on the interactions, which is what the cross-section is telling you about. It also depends on the initial conditions. So what was your target and what was the number of particles you're delivering? And so all I'm doing is writing that, but I'm avoiding writing, normally you would have written here things like the product over the number of particles in the initial state. So it would be curly n I. But that's, in particle physics, what we do, because we normally don't have a lot of particles. But really, the proper statement here, we should be keeping track of the statistics of the particles. And so you remember that, so let me write the expression and then I'll come back and justify it. So what we'll have is we'll have the product over all the particles in the initial state of the number of particles. But then we'll also should have the product over all the particles in the final state, which I guess we're calling J, of 1 of n plus or minus 1. So if you're a particle physicist, you don't normally see that factor. Normally you would just say that the likelihood of a collision depends on how many particles I'm colliding with. And so that's all this is saying. And this factor is the thing that's expressing the fact that if minus sign is a fermion and plus sign is a boson. And this is saying that if I have a fermion and I already have occupied the state, then this process should be forbidden. So n minus 1 would be 0 in that case, if n is 1. But if I have a boson, this is the the N plus one means that if I have already some bosons, I'd love to have more because this is the statement of stimulated emission. These factors are not magic. They're coming to you from the creation annihilation operators that you know about in field theory already. So I'm probably beating a dead horse here, so complain if this is something that you're already happy with. But so these factors here are coming about because you're supposed to remember that you have multiparticle states. If I have, let's say, n counts states with specific labels, specific quantum numbers. So for example, if I had three photons, n would be three here for a specific, so it might be labeled by their spin, their momentum, and whatever else you choose to label them by. You know that in quantum field theory, you're describing these things, matrix elements of these things in terms of creation and annihilation operators, where A, acting on n, removes a particle. But the normalization condition is that there's a square root of n here, because if I take this, the inner product with itself, you know, n, A star A n, and I just said that I had a number here. Let's say I put a C there, a C squared. I would have had n minus 1, n minus 1. That's 1, but this is the number operator, and so this actually is n. And so that tells you why you have the normalization of the states is telling you how this factor depends on n. And the same argument for A star says that if I act on an n particle state, I get the square root of n plus 1. So these factors of n and n plus 1 are coming about because all the things in the initial state had to be destroyed. So they're arising in the calculation of the rate in a thing like this. So you're always getting a factor of this in the amplitude. And when you square it, you're getting this factor of n in the rate. That's kind of why you're counting the number of particles, if you just wanted to see why the algebra told you that. And this is what I did. What I did here was for bosons, for fermions. So I should have had... if I have an n particle state where for fermions n is 0 or 1, then it's the same rule, but now it's minus here because what should have happened is that I should take the 0 particle state. So then I would have, oops, that's not right. Yeah, 1 plus or minus n, sorry. So the acting on the 0 particle state, I always get the 1 particle state for bosons and fermions, but acting on the 1 particle state for fermions, I get 0, which is what I should be getting. For bosons, I get the 1 plus n, which is coming from the algebra. So when you square that, and the things in the final state, they're always appearing because they had to be created. And so those are the guys, that's why you're always getting these factors. So these are coming from the A stars in the process, and these are coming from the A's. And that's why they're kind of universal. But physically, they can make sense. Physically, this is expressing you get a reaction, more reactions, the more particles you have colliding. And this is expressing then the Pauli blocking and the lasing of the bosons. And I'm flogging it because there's a very general argument. If you really have detailed balance going on, the important thing is that the unitarity of the S matrix says if you want this, you ask for this to be zero, that difference, the factors that are not this, so the cross-section and the velocity, they just depend on instead of the final initial going to final, you're just changing the final goes to initial. But basically, the unitarity of the S matrix says that the factor that you have in both these things is the same. When you sum over all the states, the difference between these rates is controlled really by this factor. If you want this to be zero for all choices of initial and final states, which for all choices of J, then what you're essentially asking is that this is the same for all choices of states that you could have made because of the unitarity of the S matrix. That's the key observation. So the claim is detailed balance and the unitarity of S imply that what you're asking is that the product over all initial states, so what I need to do is now track the let me write it down and then argue for it, because I'll get it wrong if I don't do it that way. Yeah, simplest way is, let's just do this, do an example. So let's do, let me write it down and I'll do the example. So there, so the condition is, all the guys in the initial state, if I take the product of 1 plus or minus n, what am I, n, that should be equal to the product over all the things in the final state of the same thing. So the way to think about that is, let's just take an example. So let's say we have a two particle. I need a board here. Let's just change these boards. AB goes to CD. So then we would have had the rate in one direction would have been NA times NB times 1 plus or minus NC, 1 plus or minus ND. That would be appearing here, let's say. And then we'd be comparing it to the rate where it goes the other direction. So CD goes to AB. We would have had the rate NC, ND times 1 plus or minus NA, 1 plus or minus NB. And then they would be factors that, which involve the S matrix for going from AB to CD and back, which are essentially equal once we do the sums because of the unitarity of the S matrix. So the condition for detailed balance is that these things are equal for all choices of A, B, C, and D. And so the criterion I wrote there, all I've done is I've taken all the A's and put them on one side. So this equals this. I'll divide by these factors. I guess I did it the other way around. I divided by these factors, divided by these factors, and you get that condition, that the product of over all the particles on one side of the reaction of 1 plus or minus n divided by n is the same before and after the collision. And the reason for saying it that way is that that makes it, that fits into all the words I've been saying until now. That, so the criterion for detailed balance is that before the reaction happened, if you made this combination of densities, you should have gotten the same thing after the reaction. That's saying that that thing is conserved in the reaction. So if you have something, a bunch of reactions that are happening that are very fast, you're trying to look at things at long times, and you're asking under what circumstances will it very robustly be true that the things are stationary because the rates of scattering are the same. It'll be true whenever these quantities are conserved, but normally in a particular system, you know what all the conserved things are. There's not a lot of things that are conserved, right? There's energy, there's momentum, there's baryon number, lepton number, charge. So that means that these are not quite conserved. Normally, when we think of conserved things, we think of additively conserved things, that things that whose value I add the contributions for every particle, like electric charge. If I wanted the electric charge of these particles, I would have taken the charge of A plus the charge of B. And this does not look like a sum, but if I take the logarithm of this, it will be a sum, right? Another way of saying this would have been, I want the sum over A of the log of 1 plus or minus N over NA. These are the curly N's. Should be the sum over A. So the statement of detailed balance is that this should be a sum of all the conserved things in your problem. So let's use a different letter for that. Let me use, because of my notes, I use K to label the particle states, and I'll use A to label the conserved things. So what are the conserved things we know about? We know four momentum, so there should be something times the four momentum, and so with some coefficient, which we'll call beta. And then you'll have a bunch of charges that are scalars, including electric charge, say, and they'll have a bunch of coefficients, which we'll call mu. A equals all conserved things. And these are just arbitrary coefficients. And the number of them is you have one for every conserved thing. And so we can solve this as a function of the conserved things now. So if we, you know, this P is a conserved thing, but if I now think of applying it to a particle, a state with some specific number of particles, then what will happen is that I can think of this as, let me again write the answer. So the solution to that is that N sub K is the one that you know and love, right? It's just 1 over E to the, you know, let's say you've used different notation here. I'm ready, right? I'll call that C of So this, all I'm saying is that if I solve this for n by exponentiating and then solving for n, that's the solution. And it's just showing you that, and I'm evaluating p and q for the states that are involved here. I'm summing over all the particle states k. So I'm going to label the eigenstate of p for state k. I'll call that p sub k, mu, and the eigenstate of charge QA acting on the state K will be Q sub KA. That's what these things are. And these are the coefficients that went along the ride. And we normally, what we would do is, conventionally, we would say, we'll call C sub A, we'll call that mu A over T. The momentum we don't normally track because we normally choose a frame where we're in the rest frame of the fluid. So we normally we choose this momentum to be zero. So we don't normally track the space part of this. So we normally chose PI to be zero. So the rest frame of the fluid. And then the time component, that's what we normally would have called 1 over t. That's what we would mean by t. And so then this becomes the usual 1 over e to the energy minus mu over t minus or plus 1, where, you know, the energy is just pk0, the time component of p, and mu sub k. So the chemical potential for particle type k comes to you as sum over all the charges of the chemical potential for that charge times the charge that the particle of interest carries. That's what mu is. And this mu is the one that is related to c by that. So these distributions don't change in a relativistic system. Take them to the bank. The only thing that changes is that you're supposed to use the relativistic expression here. This is p squared plus m squared for that particle. The chemical potential is the chemical potential. The interpretation of the chemical potential is, again, you know, if you have something conserved, you get to specify its density. And the way you'll adjust that, the way this distribution will know that you've specified the density is that you'll use mu to do that. So if you calculate the density of the conserved charge using these distributions, then you can adjust the value you get for it by adjusting what mu is. And your physical intuition for it should be the same as it was non-relativistically. And non-relativistically, that intuition was that mu is the energy cost, essentially, for adding a particle to your bath. You're imagining that you have a bath where you're exchanging these particles with some heat bath. And so relativistically, because what should happen is that in the extreme relativistic limit, the energy cost for a particle is going to be like the mass of the particle. And so this mu is going to like to be, for non-relativistic systems, it's going to basically be the rest mass of the particle plus some small thermodynamic correction. So typically, mu sub k is physically the average energy cost of adding a particle k. And so that's going to, for non-relativistic systems, mu sub k will be approximately the mass of that particle plus some small change, delta mu sub k. And this is what you, in non-relativistic physics, normally call the chemical potential. So it's the thing that you're used to thinking about as the chemical potential that's a function of t and does something as t goes to zero is that thing. And what's normally happening is that the chemical potential, what we're talking here, is really the turning into the rest mass, because that's the thing that turns into the energy cost per particle. So this is the intuition that you would have had, and that's still true. The main difference is that the temperature dependencies you're used to are not this one, it's this one. But the way you do it is you follow your nose with this derivation, that the if you're in equilibrium, then you know that these distributions are the ones that you have to be talking about. And they're labeled by temperature because they're labeled by temperature and chemical potential because that's the statement that you're tracking those things because they live for a long time compared to the collision time. Now the music is starting to play. So that's probably a good place to stop. So give me a sense of how my sense having had this lecture is that this was too much time on this topic. So it's a question of what I'm trying to do is set up. When you're doing the abundance calculations, I want you to be thinking in terms of the chemical potential, but I want to break the intuition, if you had had it, that this chemical potential is the one that you're used to talking about in the non-relativistic case. But I didn't want you to think you had to give everything up. So most of what you're used to doing is still true. It's just that you're only allowed to track things that are conserved. And when we go through and look at the chemical potential for various particles, the way we'll evaluate it for the chemical potential for protons is we'll do something like this where we'll have the baryon potential, but then we'll be guaranteed that because of this expression, that since we're weighting the chemical potential of the charge, that's the thing we have to dial, the chemical potential for the particle is always weighted by the charge that particle carries. And so the chemical potential for an antiproton will always be minus the chemical potential of the proton. The piece depends on baryon number. So I'll be using those when we actually do the calculation. Anyway, so enough said.